When we were together last week, we were looking at some of the numerical sayings. For example, verse 15, the leech has two daughters, give, give. And Agur, now Laura, you haven't been here, so let me just point out, this chapter is written by a man named Agur, A-G-U-R. That's how it's spelled in my translation. Apparently he was a non-Israelite, as was the one who wrote chapter 31. But he's showing wonderful wisdom and challenges here, and a lot of food for thought, things to chew on. And as he gets into this, he gives several numerical statements. And here's another one of these, second part of verse 15. There are three things that are never satisfied, four never say enough. The grave, the barren womb, the earth that's not satisfied with water, and the fire never say enough. And as we were going down through that last week, I came across an article this past week, and it caught my attention, about a couple, let's see where they were living. Maybe some of you heard about this. In Seattle, that are expecting four children. Anybody hear about that? They spent 10 years trying to conceive, and now they're expecting four children. And at first you think, well, they take, you know, what do they call it? The drugs that, fertility drugs? No. Misty and Brian Baker had been drained financially and emotionally by in vitro fertilization when their friends, Brian and Amber Pluckbaum from Indiana, stepped in to help. Pluckbaum, who has two children of her own, agreed to be a gestational surrogate for the Bakers. Dr. William Gentry from Indianapolis selected the two healthiest embryos created by the Bakers to implant in Pluckbaum and implanted four lesser quality embryos in Mrs. Baker. The doctor's thought was, why not both of you try? I mean, who knows? I think Misty's thought was, sure, why not? But it's not going to work with me. It never has worked. However, now both women learned that they're pregnant, and they're both pregnant with twins. Baker's carrying a boy and a girl to be named Connor and Hope. Pluckbaum is carrying two girls to be named Madison and Victoria. And I just thought when I looked at the first part of that, as we talked about a barren womb and how desperate some people can be and to what lengths they go, that was certainly a part of the Baker's thing. 10 years, drained financially, drained emotionally, and now all of a sudden they're four. I wish them well, but we'll see. Something else I was going to share even before I got to that, but we'll save that for another time. Here's another of the numerical statements then. We finished those last week, and I just plugged that little illustration in for what it's worth. Verse 18 begins the next one. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yes, four, which I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with the virgin. Now, before I chatter on too much here tonight, let me just ask you to take a stab at that. What's this about? The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, the way of a man with a virgin. Yeah.
Ship in the sea, the little rudder. I don't know for sure what they meant by that. And the hormonal changes that go on in everybody's life, which they didn't know, but you see the influence of it.
Yes.
slithering snake leaves no trail on the rock. A ship leaves no trail in the sea. And a man leaves no mark after he's left the conversion.
Is that the MacArthur Bible?
My oldest brother just sent me a used one recently. And I'm certain to read his notes in that. I saw the same thing this week. Anybody else want to take a stab at it? By the way, I don't have a particular right or wrong, but I'll give you some thoughts, of course. Okay. In the past, when I've read this, the wonder of those four things to me was not knowing the course that each one's going to follow. I mean, when you see an eagle in the air or a snake on a rock or a ship in the sea and so forth, which way is it going to take? A man with a maiden. Going to go this way? Going to go that way? Don't know. Okay. Now, that kind of can blend in with hypocrisy. Derek Kidner said it would be better to see the point as that of easy mastery by the appropriate agent of elements of as difficult to navigate as the air, as a rock, as the sea, and as a young woman. And when I read that, I put a little note to myself, in the current culture, that's politically incorrect. Because be labeled sexist, but if that's the case, then what Agur is saying would be this: the way of an eagle in the air, here we face the marvel of flight, John, kind of what you're looking at, and the gracefulness, the speed of an eagle, are proverbial that way. The way of a serpent on a rock, the wonder of the movement of a reptile without the benefit of legs or wings. By the way, not just a serpent on the rock, but I don't think I'll ever forget, in my earlier days here with you, the Hugh Robertsons came through for a visit. Their boys were young, and the young children and the younger Robertson children were out playing. We were standing outside on a summer day talking, and there was a lot of excitement going on. And you can see the kids watching something in the grass, and here came a chicken snake. And it seems like the oldest Robertson boy was throwing a stick at it and so forth. But finally it got near a tree in their front yard. It seemed like you had a beech tree or what's the tree that the bark peels off? At your yard. You had a maple there? And there was one, and there was a great big tree beside. But this snake, and I've never seen it before or since, he went up that tree like a squirrel, and as fast as a squirrel. And he got out on a branch, and the wind is blowing, and he made his way, and I don't know how he even touched a little bit of a branch on this big tree and went in. And Dave, there was a hole in that tree that you'd think there were squirrels or something in. I expected he went in that hole, and I thought there'd be squirrels just bailing out of there. And that's where he camped for a while till we left. So the way of a serpent on a rock, then the way of a ship in the midst of the sea. How is it that ships can plow through, navigate large bodies of water, fierce storms, elements of the weather, and the way of a man with a virgin? Some see this as the affectionate courting of a woman. William MacDonald says the simplest explanation of that expression refers to the instinct of courtship. It's interesting, John, you used the expression, the hormonal changes that go on and so forth in young man and woman, and seeing that going on here. But it's interesting, MacArthur's statements, and John, David, I was interested as you read that, because he picked up on the possibility of seeing this from the vantage point of hypocrisy and illustrating hypocrisy. And when it came to the last one, a man leaving no mark after he slept with a virgin. You know, I don't want to see that. When I'm reading the text, I don't want to go there. And yet, I know that not only in our own culture is that there, but just by the sake of our being fallen human beings from time immemorial, that has been the normal temptation, and some have succumbed to it. In fact, MacArthur says it may be hitting closer to the point of the very next verse. Verse 20, this is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats, wipes her mouth, and says, I haven't done anything wrong. I've done no wickedness. That is, each of the actions that are described in verses 18 and 19 are all concealed. They can be done either out of sight of most eyes or in complete secrecy. And they serve to illustrate the hypocrisy of this adulterous woman who hides the evidence of her shame while professing innocence. I think those were MacArthur's quotes, by the way. Those are his words in that. In my Reformation Bible, a little note here, it reads the expression, eats and wipes her mouth. Isn't that a strange thing? You go to the meal, you eat, you wipe your mouth. My wife, the older I get, says, Dan, wipe your mouth. You know, I'm not feeling it, okay? But is that what this is about? No, it's not. In fact, back in chapter 9, verse 17, as Solomon, in that case, was talking about an immoral woman, she makes an appeal that says, stolen waters are sweet. Bread eaten in secret is pleasant. And the whole point of that is the enjoying the sensual forbidden fruit secretly is a pleasant thing. And so her adultery has become as a natural to her as eating. She eats, wipes her mouth, and says, I haven't done anything wrong. And leave it to old Matthew Henry, the old Puritan who was given so much good insight into God's Word. And some of this has the old, I think he was 1600s. So you'll have to endure that difference in the English language between those several hundred years. But reflecting on verse 20, he said this, the cursed arts which a vile adulteress has to conceal her wickedness, especially from her husband, from whom she treacherously departs, so close are her intrigues with her lewd companions, so craftily disguised, that it's as impossible to discover her as to track an eagle in the air. She eats the forbidden fruit after the similitude of Adam's transgression, and then wipes her mouth, that it may not betray itself, and with a bold and impudent face says, I have done no wickedness. To the world she denies the fact and is ready to swear it, that she is as chaste and modest as any woman and never did the wickedness she's suspected of. Those are the works of darkness, which are industriously kept from coming into light. To her own conscience, if she even has one left, she denies the fault and will not own that great wickedness is any wickedness at all, but an innocent entertainment. So multitudes ruin their souls by calling evil good and by outfacing their convictions with a self-justification. I got to the end of that just now and I thought, gee, Matthew, what do you really think? Comments or observations from that one? Okay, let's look at the fourth of these six numerical statements, verse 21. For three things the earth is perturbed. Yes, for four it cannot bear up. For a servant when he reigns, a fool when he's filled with food, a hateful woman when she is married, and a maidservant who succeeds her mistress. Okay, let me try this again. What's this all about? What's going on here? Let me ask you a question. Is the God of the Bible against people bettering themselves, getting ahead in life? I mean, it says here, for three things the earth is perturbed, for four it cannot bear. Here's a servant when he reigns, a maidservant, the last one in verse 23, who succeeds her mistress. Is the Bible against people getting ahead in life? No. No, not at all. In fact, you may remember when we were back in chapter 17, Solomon observed that a wise servant will rule over a son who causes shame and will share an inheritance among the brethren. He's all about wisdom and all about doing things properly and correctly. It's interesting, when Mary, the Virgin Mary, now, Luke chapter 1, had been chosen to be the mother of the Messiah, she launches into this wonderful verse of praise. It's called the Magnificat. And as she goes through that, one of the things she sets at odds is the fact that, God, you've taken the rich and powerful and you've brought them down, and you've taken the lowly and raised them up again. You're pleased to do that. You take the hungry and feed them, and the people that are so plentiful with food, you bring them the other way. Turn over to Psalm 78 just for a minute. Keep your place here if you will. You may remember Solomon's father, David, was not originally born to royalty, was he? In fact, where was David when the Lord first called him, when we first made known of him, and had Samuel the prophet go and anoint him? Out in the fields with the sheep. He was a shepherd. By the way, taking care of sheep was a prime job in Israel. People were standing in line filling out forms. That was, everybody wanted that job. No, not at all. In fact, it wasn't one of those jobs at all. But while David was in certainly a less conspicuous occupation, if you could call it that, that's exactly where God singled him out from all the rest of Israel. By the way, how well did David perform his duties as a shepherd? Faithfully, yeah. I mean, that's really at the heart. He put his whole heart into it. Here in Psalm 78, Asaph is the psalmist of this. It's a long psalm. It's 72 verses. We're not going to read them all tonight. You can breathe easy or easier. But it ends in a way that almost seems out of place. I can remember the first few times I read through the psalm and came to the end, I thought, where'd that come from? He talks about how God rejected the larger tribe of Ephraim, but instead chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And then he goes on to say this in verse 70. He also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes that had young. He brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart, and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. Now, before we get back to what Agur was saying in Proverbs 30, stop and think about what Asaph is saying here. In fact, let me ask this question. What's the significance of what he's just said when it comes to the whole topic of somebody progressing in life from one occupation or job to another? It's a radical change that David made, and as Asaph is just pointing out, obviously he didn't go immediately from shepherd to king. The Lord made sure that there was an interplay there, and a lot more experience of life experiences that he lived out before he was ready to step into the position of ruler. But what's at the heart of what he's getting at here? When David was out watching his father's sheep, did he get sidetracked at times and chase butterflies while the wolves and bears and so forth came in and took the flock? And then he lied to his dad, you know, I don't know how it happened. Yeah. I was watching him the whole time. No, the point that Asaph is making is David was faithful in the little job that God gave him. What is it that old Hudson Taylor said years ago? A little thing is a little thing, but faithfulness in a little thing is a great thing. And it's precisely when we're faithful in whatever the thing is that God gives me right now that he uses as a stepping stone to the next stage of life. And it doesn't matter whether I'm 5 or 25 or 55 or wherever I am, that's one of the principles of life. And if I've blown it when I was 5, then it's time to learn from that mistake and do better when I'm 5 and a half. Somebody was telling me, we were talking about age, and they said, isn't it interesting when you're at up through a certain age, you're never quite one age. You're 5 1/2, or I'm 5 3/4, because I'm good. Or I'm almost 6 now, you know. And you get past a certain age, and you know how you keep backing away from the numbers that are there. But the point is that it's faithfulness. And that's what the focus is here. So it's precisely because David had been faithful in caring for those poor dumb sheep who are notorious for their lack of good sense. Almost as helpless, adult sheep are almost as helpless as the lambs they give birth to. It's precisely because he was faithful with that area that he was being made ready to lead God's greater flock. That's the picture, the word picture that Asaph is pointing here. And both flocks need a shepherd who have a concern for them, not for his own sake. He has a heart for them. David had a heart, a concern for his four-legged variety flock, and he also had a heart for his two-legged variety. Perfect? No. But a leg up from the average Israelite, yes. Let's go back to Proverbs 30 again. So when Agur says here, for three things the earth is perturbed, yes, for four it cannot bear up, he's not saying that God is against getting up, doing better in your life by showing diligence and energy and some pluck about what you're about. In fact, he's not saying, as the Hindu philosophy teaches, you need to remember your place in life. You're born to a certain caste, and that's where you need to stay. Don't make any effort to improve yourself. That's not what he's saying. But Derek Kidner's right. The Bible really has no place for upstarts at the same time, people who get too big for their boots. Earlier, Solomon said in chapter 19, luxury is not fitting for a fool, much less for a servant to rule over princes. It's interesting. I'm reading from the ESV more these days. Alexander said a couple things over the last few months that's made me go back and check it more. Like the King James Version and the New King James, it's a word-for-word translation, so it's a good, accurate translation. And it begins verse 21 this way: under three things the earth trembles, under four it cannot bear up. And it's interesting, David, you have this in your MacArthur Study Bible. MacArthur writes, society is greatly agitated when normal roles are overturned. It's not that it's wrong to get ahead and improve yourself, but there's a right and a wrong way to go about it and a right and a wrong time to do it. And here's an example in verse 22, for a servant when he reigns. Now, why is that a problem? Why is it wrong for a servant to reign? Let me put it on a very good 21st century level. Why is it wrong for somebody who's only been a community organizer to suddenly become the president? And I'm saying this tonight. I know where you guys are, and you can erase that from the tape later, Al. You know, it's not bashing him, but there's a point of practicality. If I knew nothing about his ideology and so forth, I would have said, you know, you really need some more experience in that. Just from a practical point of view. You're going to lead a nation? You know, before David went from leading the flock to leading the flock of Israel, God took him through a real stressful training time. And if David, in fact, if you had told David after Samuel had anointed him, David, by the way, before you take the crown, this is what's going to, you know, I want to show you what's going to happen. Saul's going to be chasing you. You're going to be this close to death several times. It's going to be so bad, you're going to flee to the Philistines. You think David would have said, you know, can you take this oil back? You know? You know, servants don't go into, from being a servant to being a king, at least for the reason they have no experience. The average servant doesn't have the kind of practical, hands-on experience leading a body politic, leading a people, a nation. So the problem with someone who's only been a servant suddenly becoming a king is they become arrogant, they become overbearing, they become drunk with their newfound power. Back in chapter 28, Solomon said, "A poor man who oppresses the lowly is like a driving rain which leaves no food." There's a matter of not only experience, but character as well that has to be brought together. I remember reading a book, I think I was in high school, that talked about a slave rebellion in Haiti. No doubt those people were justified in rebelling when you understand that they're under the French overlords and how badly the French treated their slaves, much less their servants, but their slaves. But the slave who either led that rebellion or who, as the rebellion was wound up, eventually came out on top. And so he became the leader of the nation, was an absolute dictator himself. I mean, they went from having one group of overlords to having another, and it was as bad or worse under this guy. And the whole rebellion eventually just fell apart. I mean, life degenerated into mob rule, survival of the fittest, survival of the strongest, because the man didn't have the character, much less the experience that was needed to do it. By the way, when Agur says this, where are we here? A servant when he reigns, a fool when he's filled with food. Second one down on that the fool filled with food, he's not referring to somebody gorging themselves with local cuisine. This is a way of saying when he becomes rich, when his prosperity causes him to be more insolent than ever. Nothing wrong with getting legitimate wealth, by the way, in a legitimate way. But if somebody's lacks proper moral character, the framework from life to handle that kind of prosperity, it ruins them. It hurts them. And it hurts other people as well. So he says in verse 22, the fool who's filled with his food, that word fool is the Hebrew word Nabal, N-A-B-A-L. Anybody remember that word from your history? Some of you are shaking your head, aren't you? Yeah. By the way, before we go to the way that was used by one wife to talk about her husband, in Psalm 14, David used that word when he said, the fool has said in his heart, do you remember? There is no God. Do you know how the rest of that verse unpacks? They are corrupt. They've done abominable works. There's none who does good. That what I'm saying is when Agur describes this person who the earth cannot bear when he's filled with food, that is, when he has lots of wealth and prosperity, he's not referring to your garden variety kind of fool who maybe has a low IQ or whatever else is a problem there. This is a guy whose character is deficient because he's spiritually deficient. So when I used the word Nabal a while ago, several of you are shaking your head, and I'm sure you're referring to a woman named Abigail in David's life when he was still on the run from Saul, and that wife with incredible shrewdness after her husband had stiff-armed some of David's men who came and asked for a share in the flock as they were enjoying the shearing. And he had treated this man's men well. He had helped protect them and so forth. David was coming back to take vengeance. And Abigail, wisely, quick, loaded a mule with bread, with supplies, and made a beeline and intercepted David before he came and would have done real damage there, and probably to his regret would have done it. But nevertheless, as Abigail met David, her initial response was, "Please let not my lord," meaning David, "regard this scoundrel Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name," or Nabal is his name, "and folly is with him." Remember when John was teaching Samuel years ago in up on the hill, John, you came to that part and you said, Nabal is his name and folly is his game. So that was him. Here's something else now, under which the earth trembles, it cannot bear up. Verse 23, a hateful woman when she's married. And I can almost hear somebody, when I read that out, saying, what a cruel thing to say. I mean, how insensitive, how politically incorrect to say a hateful woman when she's married. And of course, you're right, it is politically incorrect. But I didn't say it, Agur did. And frankly, what he said is true. A hateful woman. William MacDonald comments on this, saying, a hateful woman who finally succeeds in getting married. Her wretched disposition would normally have kept her single, but by some fluke, and I thought to myself, or after several failures with potential suitors, where she blows her cover, she finally lands a husband, that lucky dog. And now the real person reveals herself, and she becomes haughty and taunting and queen, not for a day, but for however long she's there. What a cross-grained person that is. And fourth and finally, he says, here's something else that the earth is perturbed with. It cannot bear up. It's a maidservant who succeeds her mistress. By the way, do you remember any examples of someone like this in Scripture? Hagar? Yeah. Remember the story of Hagar in Genesis? Let me just read the opening verses of Genesis chapter 16. Now, Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abraham, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. Then Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar and she conceived. Now here's the point. When she saw that she had conceived, do you remember what happened? Her mistress became despised in her eyes. I thought to myself, boy, that's when the real fun began in that household. Maybe the problem with the maidservant who succeeds her mistress here is similar to the problem there at the first part of verse 22, a servant when he reigns. Neither are equipped with the experience, with the character to do what they need to deal with their new position and everything that's put on them. One man wrote, the intimation of this passage is that when people are suddenly promoted and moved from an inferior position to a decidedly higher one, they become excessively pretentious and arrogant and disagreeable. Any comments or observations? So, David, if you're invited to be president next week, I expect better of you. We all do. Okay? Well, let's stop with that. Let's close with prayer. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for these thoughts from a man that we don't expect to meet in any way except in heaven. Thank you for preserving his words and for the truth that's there. Help us to understand them and hide them well in our hearts and minds. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.